To talk with Art Bell, call the Wildcard Line at area code 775-727-1295. The first-time caller line is area code 775-727-1222. To talk with Art Bell from east of the Rockies, call toll-free at 800-825-5033. From west of the Rockies, call 800-618-8255. International callers may reach Art by calling your in-country Sprint access number, pressing option 5. And dialing toll-free 800-893-0903. From coast to coast and worldwide on the Internet, this is Coast to Coast AM with Art Bell.
Blowing it sky high is the job of my guest coming up, Dr. Michael Shermer. He is a skeptic. In fact, Dr. Michael Shermer is the founding publisher of Skeptic Magazine, so he's got to be like the 800-pound gorilla of skeptics. He's director of the Skeptics Society. See, there you go. Monthly columnist for Scientific American, the host of the Skeptics Distinguished Science Lecture Series at the California Institute of Technology, and the co-host and producer of a Fox Family series entitled Exploring the Unknown. Wow. Dr. Shermer received his B.A. in psychology from Pepperdine, his M.A. in experimental psychology from California State University, Fullerton, and his Ph.D. in the history of science from Claremont Graduate University. He's author of several books, including The Science of Good and Evil, Why People Cheat, Gossip, Share, Care, and Follow the Golden Rule, On the Evolutionary Origins of Morality, and How to Be Good Without God. Can you be good without God? In addition, he has appeared on many national television programs as a skeptic of weird and extraordinary claims. Tonight, he is here. And now, here is Dr. Michael Shermer. Hey, welcome to the program, Doctor.
Good evening.
Good evening. It's great to have you. Where are you?
I'm in Altadena, California.
Altadena, California.
That's right on the borders there of Pasadena.
Okay. I am most curious to know what kind of person a skeptic is, and boy, you're really at the top of the list after having read what I read introducing you here. You're really at the top of the list. So, I mean, what kind of person becomes, well, I don't know, a skeptic? What kind of guy are you? I mean, do you kick cats? Do you
really, a skeptic is not
dislike
noun,
little
so much as it's just a way of thinking.
A way of thinking?
Yeah, it's a scientific way of thinking, just looking for the evidence, checking to see what's the quality of the evidence, how sound is the logic and rationality behind a particular claim. You can't just be a skeptic, because it depends on the claim being made. There are people who claim that the Holocaust never happened, and they're Holocaust skeptics, and I investigated that and ended up becoming a skeptic of the skeptics instead of the claim. So,
have you investigated the 9/11 event?
Yeah, sure.
Are you at all skeptical of the official explanation of what occurred?
In general, no.
No?
I think the evidence is pretty overwhelming.
Think so?
Yeah.
There's a growing body of people out there, Doctor, that I tell you, it's a movement. There was no plane that crashed into the Pentagon, and on and on and on and on.
Yeah. It depends on the particular claim. Again, it's not that conspiracies can't happen. They do. Lincoln, for example, was assassinated by a conspiracy, but Kennedy wasn't, in my opinion. So, again, we have to take them one at a time. Where's all the evidence for the plane that hit the Pentagon? Well, where's the evidence of the planes that hit the World Trade Center? They disintegrated, too. The planes disintegrate. There's no body parts because they disintegrated. That's what happens when planes hit at high speed like that. So, again, we have to just take these one at a time, like the claim we never landed on the moon, and the people, I call them the no-moonies.
Yeah.
You know, they have like 20 to 30 different specific arguments that they make. And
so far, I'm in agreement with you. I mean, I'm sure we went to the moon. I've had very compelling, strong, impassioned arguments made by people who say we didn't. And, you know, they throw out certain facts or what they think are facts. But I don't buy it. We landed on the moon. The 9/11 thing is, you know, so you're in safe territory with me so far. Mm-hmm. But there's, you know, there's a lot of other things. Mm-hmm. My goodness, a lot of other things.
So you asked how, you know, how I became a skeptic. I actually used to believe a lot of the paranormal stuff when I was in a graduate program in experimental psychology in the mid-1970s. Uri Geller was all the rage, you know, the Israeli spoon-bending psychic.
Yes.
And I remember seeing articles about him by experimental psychologists, PhDs who had tested him. And these were people that, you know, were really smart and well-educated, and I wanted to be a PhD psychologist, and I thought, well, they say there's something to it. There must be something to it. And there was a paranormal lab set up at UCLA by Thelma Moss, and I thought, wow, okay, those people are, they're really smart and educated, so there must be something to this. And then I saw the amazing Randy, James Randy, on The Tonight Show with Johnny Carson, and he was doing all the same so-called paranormal tricks that the psychics were doing, and I thought, oh, well, there's something going on here. And Randy made an interesting point that I'll never forget, and that is that scientists are not trained to look for intentional deception. They're looking for unintentional deception by nature, camouflage and
true.
Hidden patterns and things like that. But
true.
Sometimes people just cheat and lie.
Sometimes.
And make stuff up. And
yeah.
Scientists are no better than anybody else at detecting that. So that told me that we can all be fooled. And then the study of illusion and magic showed me how easy it is, actually, and for any of us to be fooled. And then when you get into the study of self-deception, it becomes even more powerful and obvious. How...
I know a number of witches, doctor, and they fully believe their power is absolutely real, that the magic they do is very, very real.
Mm-hmm.
Have you ever encountered a witch, looked into witchcraft at all?
Mm-hmm.
And what have you found?
Yeah, I think there's a similar effect as with the psychics, that there's a lot of self-deception going on there.
Mm.
They get a lot of reinforcement from their followers that they're doing something very effective, and that makes them think that they are effective. And so what kicks in then is something called the confirmation bias, where we look for and find confirmatory evidence for what we already believe, and we ignore disconfirmatory evidence. And so this is what fuels conspiracy theories. Once you have the conspiracy theory in place, it's easy to find evidence to support it and just ignore all the evidence that doesn't fit.
Mm-hmm.
And you don't need much evidence to reinforce something you really want to believe. So, for example, people that go to psychics, we've tape recorded the readings, and you can count the number of hits and misses just based on the people nodding yes or no. And the hit rate is pretty low. It's like 10 to 15% correct. And in that context, you think, well, why? Why would anybody believe that? But in fact, what you see is them saying, well, it's incredible that he got
But doctor, let me just stop you for a second. If, going by your own words, you said the hit rate is 10 to 15%.
Mm-hmm.
When you're talking about somebody reciting completely random things.
No, but they're not. But they're not random.
Oh.
In fact, they...
So well, then what are you qualifying as hits?
Well, things like, he got the name of my Uncle George or something like that. Well, when you actually look at the reading, you see the psychic rattling off names. I'm getting a Michael, a Mark, a Mary, a Sam, you know, and so on. And finally, he hits the name, and the person says, yeah, well, George, right, that's my great uncle who passed on. Oh, okay. And then they just feed it back to them and say, no, don't tell me who it is. I'm getting a George here. And the person will actually forget that they told them and then misremember it as being something that the psychic got instead of what they gave him.
Hmm.
Or they'll say things that are true for everybody. Like if it's a psychic who talks to the dead, which, by the way, anybody can talk to the dead. It's getting the dead to talk back that's the hard part.
Mm-hmm.
It's a matter of just repeating things that are true for everybody. So anybody that's lost somebody will have a keepsake with them, particularly if they go to these readings. A photograph, a piece of jewelry, men who've lost their fathers typically have their father's watch on.
Yes.
That kind of thing. So you'll see the psychics, they say this every reading. I'm getting a watch. He's telling me something about a watch. I don't know what this means. Of course he knows what it means.
Hmm.
You know, so sometimes it's just an outright scam. that is being perpetrated on people, and they don't realize it.
But, Doctor, surely we do not understand everything about the human brain yet. We're far from that.
Yes.
Right? So, doesn't it stand to reason that perhaps there are people scattered among the frauds out there who really have developed a portion of their brain that we don't know anything about yet and are able to do things like predict events or take remote viewing, for example, something that apparently most people have a discipline. Have you looked at remote viewing? It's very interesting.
Yeah, I took a course in it and I taped the whole show on it and so on. Okay, the first part of your statement was correct. There's a lot we don't know about the human brain and the mind. And
indeed.
What is mind and where is consciousness located? Where is the sense of self located? Things like this.
Yes.
But to go from that to, and therefore, isn't it possible that some people have developed some part of their brain? Well, no, that's not a conclusion you can draw from.
Why not?
A simple unknown fact.
Why not?
Because that would require something completely different. For thoughts to actually leave your skull and traverse across space and go through somebody else's skull into their brain and influence their neurons. We know how neurons work.
Well, I know it sounds fantastic, Doctor, but have you been looking into the quantum world?
Yes.
Well, have you
in
now?
Fact, I just reviewed this film, What the Bleep Do We Know, for Scientific American.
Yes.
And here's the problem there, is that quantum effects occur at a subatomic level.
Yes.
Neuronal effects of where thought occurs is at a molecular level. It's about three orders of magnitude too big for quantum effects to take effect. They simply can't. It's too big of a leap. It's a quantum leap, if you will.
Well, this whole statement you're making is a bit of a quantum leap, isn't it?
Listen. There's a simple physics problem here. These quantum effects, weird as they are, all occur at the level below the size of the atom itself. They're happening down at the size of electrons.
But Doctor, let's stop at quantum for a second, okay? I mean, just the fact that these effects occur at all are beyond everything we know. Now, we've confirmed they do occur. These quantum effects do occur. Doesn't that make you scratch your little skeptic skull?
No, because they've been confirmed experimentally.
Yes, indeed so.
They're true.
But we don't know how, do we?
Well, we have some idea of how, and that the fact that there's a level of uncertainty, that itself is built into the fabric of nature. But that doesn't mean that the level of uncertainty leaps across that space gap to a macro level at which neurons occur. So although it's true that the wave function doesn't collapse until it's observed, the moon exists, whether it's observed or not, because the quantum effects are all washed out at the macro level. So there's no application across that gap.
Nevertheless, we don't understand how the macro communication or the quantum communication, which appears to occur at the speed of, much faster than light, instantaneously, we just don't even begin to understand.
That's right. That's correct.
Okay, so
that's a quantum level, not the macro level at which we live at.
Well,
I mean,
if there's that much we don't know about the quantum process, then, reasonable speculation could go all over the place here.
Okay, here's the problem, is that we have two mysteries. One is, how does the quantum effects occur? And two, how do you explain consciousness from neurons firing?
Okay,
it's possible that the causal arrow goes down to the subatomic level. I think that's too much physics envy. One of the problems of science is that there's too much physics envy. Everybody thinks the big brother physics is the place we have to go to explain something ultimately, and I think that's wrong. I think we have to go in the other direction toward emergence, self-organization, chaos theory, complexity theory. The consciousness as a problem to solve is going to occur at a higher level than neurons firing. It's going to occur at groups of neurons firing, patterns of neurons firing. Mm. Patterns, systems, networks, neural networks, things like that. That's where the explanation for consciousness is going to come from, at a higher level. Biology and systems theory is where the causal arrow should go, not down into the world of physics, but up into the world of systems.
Well, it just seems to me, though, that the amount we don't understand about the quantum process alone should cause you to be at least a little concerned.
concerned
from
about
a,
what?
Well, from a skeptic's point of view. In other words, that, well, gee, you know, if this actually is really happening, it's so impossible, according to everything we understand with physics, right? It's just beyond
Here's the problem, is that we have this micro quantum level and this macro level of classical physics.
Yes.
And there's two different physics going on, and no one has figured out how to unite the two. Okay.
But so that should be a problem for you, too. I mean, you can't have two different sets of physics, right?
Art, the fact that there's something we can't explain doesn't open the door for all mysteries to be real.
Well, it does open a lot of doors, though. You know, when you talk to the remote viewers and you do observe.
Okay, but look, there's nothing in remote viewing that needs explaining because there's no phenomenon to explain.
Oh?
Yeah, I've looked into this.
And
what happens when remote viewers are remote viewing is they're doing this kind of psychological game where they're drawing little pictures of things, and then at some point, somebody has to make an interpretation of whether that drawing is a hit or a miss, and that's where the subjectivity comes in. It's not an objective science. It's not where you have a multiple choice and they've statistically gotten a significant number of hits above chance. And when you do set it up like that, there is no effect that needs explaining. It's the same thing with all the psychics. There's simply nothing to explain whether quantum effects are weird or not. They don't have to be employed because there's nothing to explain. When you put psychics under controlled conditions, the effect fades. It disappears. They only operate well when there's this subjective element of what constitutes a hit. So I'm getting a red dress. What does that mean? Oh, the red dress means my mother gave it to me when I was 8. Okay. That's a hit? No. That's too subjective.
No, but if there's a target, for example, of a remote viewer staring at a bridge in Great Britain, and somebody over on the side draws a bridge and the surrounding countryside, I mean, that's a pretty good hit, isn't it?
Well, from what you just described, yeah, but that's not actually what happens.
No,
you read the sort of tabloid equivalent explanations of these things, and it sounds impressive. When you actually read the scientific papers about it, you see where the flaws are, and the effects are not real. The effects are not replicable. This is one of the problems of sort of voodoo science, is where one lab gets an effect and no one can duplicate it, like with cold fusion. It's not impossible. It's entirely possible. It's just that once the announcement was made and other scientists rushed out in their labs to do it and nobody could replicate it, well, within weeks, we realized, okay, there's something else going on here.
Nobody said nobody could replicate it. Not everybody could replicate it. Some did replicate it. Others did not. Be fair.
You're talking about cold fusion?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, obviously, if cold fusion was real, we'd have cold fusion machines in our kitchens by now, and we don't.
Well,
and
you
so
know, this
if
jumps
the effect
into another
is,
interesting
there's something
area.
Wrong with the claimed effect if virtually no one can get it to occur again.
Well, but that wasn't true. There were a number of universities that did, and then a number that didn't, and a big controversy, I'll grant you. And I'm not saying that cold fusion is real, although the experiments now have been relegated to Europe, as I'm sure you're aware.
Well, fine, yeah. I mean, even if Americans are too dogmatic or closed-minded or whatever, you know, people in Japan are trying to replicate cold fusion. There's some people in Europe. If it was real, somebody would have nailed it down by now because it's been, you know, 15 years now. Yeah, 15 years. So when an effect goes on and on like that, like aliens, UFOs, Loch Ness Monster, Bigfoot, you know, decades go by and no one can find a body, no one can find physical evidence, that should be a clue that skepticism is probably most appropriate.
Huh. Well, it is appropriate in many cases. I'm also kind of skeptical about a lot of things, but also very open, and that's where I think the division is between yourself and myself. I'm open to some possibilities, and I don't see how you couldn't be.
It depends what you mean by open and which particular claim you're asking somebody to be open about.
Well, all right.
You can't just be open about everything.
All right, I'm open, for example, about EVP. I bet you're familiar with that, electronic voice phenomena. The voices of the dead being recorded, you're familiar with that.
Mm-hmm.
That one leaves me open. I'm unable to shoot a hole in what a lot of these people are doing. And are you, you get holes shot in that very easily? You shoot holes in it, or what?
Voices on machines, the the few I've heard, they always sound kind of unclear. It's not amidst a bunch of noise. What is it exactly we're hearing?
All right, there is a good place to stop. It's bottom of the hour. Hold it right there. What exactly are we hearing? I agree with that. The voices of the dead or a hoax?
Talk with Art Bell. Call the Wildcard line at area code 775-727-1295. The first time caller line is area code 775-727-1222. To talk with Art Bell from east of the Rockies, call toll free at 800-825-5033. From west of the Rockies, call Art at 800-618-8255. International callers may reach Art Bell by calling your in-country Sprint access number, pressing option 5, and dialing toll-free 800-893-0903.
I'm already getting past last saying, Art, I can't stand it. My blood pressure is going up. This guy's driving me crazy. Well, this guy is Dr. Michael Shermer. He is a skeptic, and he's telling us why. We'll be right back. Subject, ghosts, or electronic voice phenomena, the voice of voices of the dead, actually. Dr. Shermer, welcome back. I've heard some rather clear recordings, actually, over many, many shows of people. I don't know, these people are pretty good people up in Utah, and they haven't written a book. They're not making any money. They never come on here and sell anything at all. They simply gather together with recorders and go to graveyards, places like that, and get these voices for which there appears no other possible explanation. You rule out, you know, radio stations. They're brand new tapes, never been recorded on previously. So, you know, where do the voices come from? I try and shoot holes in it myself, but the voices are there. Saying relative things, by the way, I might add, contemporary things, showing they're in the moment, that sort of thing. It's pretty wild.
Mm-hmm. Well, in a way, this is a signal noise problem. It's the same problem the SETI people have in determining whether a signal that's coming from outer space is part of the regular background noise you get, or whether it's a signal like, you know, aliens are sending, you know, a significant number or something like that. You know, I haven't heard every single tape anybody's made, but the ones I hear, you know, they're never really all that clear. You know, usually the claimant says something like, here, you can clearly hear, he says, whatever.
Yeah.
And when you hear it without that context, it just, to me, sounds like noise. I don't hear it.
Really?
Yeah.
Well, some of them, I will grant you, can be very interpretive. But a few times I've heard ones, there's nothing interpretive about them at all. I mean, they're exceptionally clear. Mm-hmm. And
but this is a little bit like the play the Beatles albums backwards and looking for the spooky words. You're going to get that where random noises occasionally sound like words. because it's like the face on Mars business. We see faces because that's what we look for, because we're human. We faces are important for us.
Our brain wants to see something we relate to. So sure, there's some of that. And then would you then also attribute that to all of these millions of UFO sightings? You know, just millions.
Well, first of all, there aren't millions.
Well, there are, actually.
And second of all, different sightings have different explanations. There's not one universal explanation for all UFO sightings. And most serious ufologists will admit that a good 90% or so of the sightings are explainable.
Sure.
So what we're down to here is looking at that 10% anomalies that are unexplained by traditional methods.
Granted.
So for me, it's perfectly okay to just say, I don't know. We don't know. We don't have a good explanation
but
for
see,
it. Let's just leave it at that.
It's not perfectly okay to say that. It's perfectly okay to say there's 10% we cannot explain. But wouldn't that justify a serious scientific investigation of... that was a yes?
Yeah,
sure. Oh, okay, good.
But a serious scientific investigation is not the same thing as aliens landed here.
No, it isn't.
We have what's called the residue problem. There'll always be a residue of unexplained anomalies that the dominant theory at the time cannot explain. And that's just simply the way it is. It's just the built-in limitations. You can't explain everything. So before you overturn the dominant theory that explains 90% of the data, however, your new theory has to explain the 90% and something more. And that's the problem with trying to introduce a new theory. It's not that paradigms can't shift and new theories can't be introduced. That happens all the time.
Yes.
It's just that it has to be a better explanation. And typically, the new explanations that are offered are not better. They're worse. It's just that they claim to explain a few of the anomalies, but they don't explain most of the other stuff.
Well, let's stick with the ghost part of it for a second and drift over toward are you skeptical entirely of life after death, life or consciousness, continued consciousness of any sort after physical death?
Yeah, I don't think there's any evidence for it at all. I think the best chance we have for that ever happening is through computer technology. That is, if we eventually can
download,
scan our neural patterns, our networks of information that are represent our personalities and memories, our cells, into computers. Silicon is a much more durable medium than the electric meat of our protein, and that can last a lot longer until we have a still hardier medium to download our memories into and into the distant future. But that's pure science fiction at the moment, although there are some people that are working on this.
So you think the only way there'll be life after death is to leap into Microsoft's world?
Something like that. Well, I'm not sure I'd want to trust a Windows platform for my eternal life, but yeah, it's along those lines.
My eternal life. Oh, well, have you given it any consideration? I mean, faced with what you as a skeptic, and I guess, well, gee, we could use other words. Are you, would you say you're agnostic, or would you not?
At this point, I would be shocked if it turned out there's a God in an afterlife. I would be amazed.
Really?
Be sitting there going, oh, my God, I can't believe it. Well, you know, great. I'm very fortunate. I'm happy that there's an afterlife, and, you know, I hope the God is a good God. And doesn't.
But you don't believe for one second there is, do you?
No, practically speaking, no. I mean, philosophically, technically, yeah, I can't prove there's no God. I can't prove there's no afterlife. But I don't think there's good enough evidence for it to make a...
Well, what about the evidence there is? I mean, like the Bible, for example. I mean, you know, there's...
The Bible has written all over it evidence of its human construction. It's socially, culturally bound. It's an edited book. It's obviously an edited book. Virtually all biblical scholars agree that this is the case. It's obviously edited. The authors are writing against each other. They're arguing amongst themselves. There were books that were left out. Well, why were they left out? Because there was a committee that voted books should go in, which books should go out. What do you mean a committee that voted?
Yeah, there was.
Yeah. So, and the stories are very human. they have written all over them the culture of the times. I mean, the laws of Deuteronomy and Leviticus, for example, are absurd. I mean, you know, that adulterous women should be put to death. That's not something we would obey today. Disobedient children should be stoned to death? Come on. you know, and about not wearing certain clothing fabrics together, not eating certain kinds of foods. These were rules written for people 4,000 years ago.
Yeah, I'm not in favor of any of that.
In a very different context.
Now, but I don't know that that invalidates the whole Bible and the fact that you obviously then don't embrace the concept that Jesus walked on earth as a man, huh?
I think there probably was a man named Jesus who definitely was a man who walked on earth. What I cannot make the leap of faith, and that's really what it has to be,
is that he was God.
Uh-huh. Yeah, that he was reincarnated, that essentially he was brought back from the dead.
Mm-hmm.
That, I think, is not a provable tenet. That is an article of faith. You either take the leap of faith and believe it, or you don't. And if you don't believe it, there's no point in being a Christian. You should be a Jew or something else.
Well,
And this is the problem I see it. The whole science and religion business is that the attempt to use science to prove articles of faith is diverting the whole point of religious faith. The whole point is just to believe, not to prove it. If you could prove it, what's the point of just believing? Everybody should be a Christian or a Jew or a Muslim.
How do you characterize those with very strong faith? I mean, how do you personally characterize them?
Well, no different than anybody of a commitment of anything else, like a political commitment. People that are heartily supporting Kerry or Bush are no different than people that heartily support Christianity or
really?
Judaism. Yeah.
Really?
These are beliefs that are arrived at for mostly psychological, emotional reasons. They're behavioral commitments that have to do with how you were raised, the belief of your parents, your peer groups, your teachers, your upbringing, that sort of thing. It has very little to do with science, reason, logic. It's a whole host of psychological factors. So people believe in Christianity for the same reason that they're Democrats or Republicans. That's
wow.
How they were raised.
That's something. You don't think there's a... Well, do you think there's a natural propensity for people to worship? I had a guest.
Yeah,
I had a guest on the show who wrote a book called the God Part of the
uh-huh.
Brain.
Yeah, I know him.
Do you know Matthew?
Mm-hmm.
Uh-huh. I thought it was very good. His whole
Your show helped kind of give his book a little boost. I think
it did.
I think there's something to that. Although I don't think there's a God gene or a God module specifically. I think it has to do with a larger suite of behavioral psychological things that are going on. For example, the whole idea of using God as an explanation for things, that's one aspect. But most people don't go to church in order to have some explanation for the origins of the universe, and that if you can only teach about the Big Bang, then people wouldn't believe in God anymore, or something like that.
Why do you think it is that even if you go to the deepest jungles of South America, where the tribe, you find the tribe that has never encountered the rest of modern humanity at all, and they indeed worship something or another, inevitably,
But that something or another is so radically different than the God
perhaps so.
That we worship.
Yes.
What it is, again, that's just an explanation for something. Let's just take modern Americans. Do they go to church on Sunday in order to hear a sermon about the origins of life? No. They go for the social aspects, the music, the culture. Their friends are there. A little moral uplift. And,
that's it,
and
huh?
Moral homilies for the children.
Sort of a nice tea party for everybody.
In a way, it is. But more than that, it's a social cohesiveness. It's a binding, a bonding of people together.
Mm.
Religion plays a really important role in uniting people, encouraging cooperation, and this is where my book comes in, of the evolution of morality. Religion plays a really important social role of reinforcing altruistic, pro-social, cooperative behavior. In other words, you should be nice instead of nasty, because we all know humans have a propensity to do nasty things. So religion was the first organized institute on the scene that codified the rules of good behavior into writing, to actually put it into stone, literally. And so what happened was about 5,000 years ago, before that, all humans were living in small bands and tribes of a couple of dozen to a couple hundred individuals, in which most behavior control could be enforced through informal means, like shunning and guilt and shame and pride and joy and things like that. And most everybody was either related to one another or they knew one another.
Mm-hmm.
So it's easy to control people's behavior that way. once populations started to grow to larger sizes, in thousands, tens of thousands, and even hundreds of thousands, there was too much anonymity. People didn't know one another, they weren't related to one another, so why should I be nice? Why should I be cooperative? Why not be an outlier, a cheater? Why not be a freeloader?
Doctor, aren't these all questions that would apply to you who would doubt all of these things? So without the restrictions applied because of religion or whatever else we could talk about, I mean, why aren't you an outlaw with low moral, or are you?
So what happened was 5,000 to 7,000 years ago is religions and state societies developed in order to codify the rules of behavior for all of us to obey a certain set of rules that make us all better, that makes us as a society better. So you actually have sort of a group selection going on here in evolution, where groups that are more cooperative and pro-social are more likely to be successful. So we actually have within us, I argue, a tendency to be moral, to be good, if it can be reinforced through culture and society. And that's what these institutions are for. I'm not saying religion's bad. In fact, religion's really good for a lot of these things. It's just that it was the first on the scene, so it has a 4,000-year head start over secular institutions. So what happened in the Enlightenment 400 years ago was the thinkers said, look, these are values that are good in and of themselves, even if there is no God, or even if you believe a different God, or you're committed to a different religion, we still hold these values to be self-evidently true, sacred, whatever term you want to use, and those are the founding fathers of our country. So the separation of church and state is actually better for religion because it protects religion, and it says to everybody who lives here, these are the rules we're going to live by, and I don't care if you believe in God or not, you still have to do this. You still have to be good, and that's good for everybody.
Right. But if you don't believe in all of these things that dictate this control you've talked about, well, then where are you?
Well, that's what states are for, too. States have laws. Actually, states are better at it than religion. Religion just has moral precepts that says you're going to be punished in the next life if you're not good.
So your morality,
what
personal
states
morality,
do is they say you're going to be punished now if you don't do
this. Then your personal morality stems from just the fact that you don't want to break the law and get in trouble?
No. In fact, that's the limitation of religious morality, is it's based on a reward and punishment system. What a secular system of morality says is that these values exist in and of themselves, that people have value in and of themselves, and we'll be better as a group if everybody does these things. And it's better if you do it now, because there is no next life to be rewarded or punished. The reward has to come now.
Oh, it jumps that far, huh?
I think so. I think it's a higher moral value to be good rather than to not be good, because people have value in and of themselves and it's better for the group than the religious system, which is based on some payoff in the distant future. I would rather know that you want to be good and nice to me because you value me, as opposed to because you think you're going to get paid off or you have fear of punishment from God. I think it would be a higher moral value if you just held those values in and of themselves, because people have value. And that's the point, I think, of the Enlightenment values that we cherish in this country, that are built into the Constitution. Regardless of your religion, these values are important.
Okay, well, yes, they are. Yes, they are. Although I'm not sure how they're inculcated without religion, then all you have is fear of punishment in the real world, court sending you away to jail or
whatever.
Because
we're used to religion. Again, religion's had a 4,000-year head start. What the secular system in America is trying to do is to say we should raise our kids to be this way and have these values regardless of what religion you are. Even if you're not religious at all, these are still good values. And so we've only had, a little over 200 years to think about this and talk about it culturally, but, religion's been doing this for thousands of years, and, they do it pretty well, but we can do it better.
Really? Well, but see, in the modern world, a lot of people have let their religion go. They've lost their religion, basically, and we see a corresponding rise in the crime rate, and particularly the terribly immoral type crimes we see a big rise in that, and a lot of people see a connection.
No, I dispute that. Actually, crime rates are much lower than they've been since the 60s.
Well, I'm talking about a larger span of time. I mean, you know, modern man.
Well, okay.
As religion has sort of slipped away.
Actually, life is much better than it was even 500 years ago. All of us are much safer than we've ever been, healthier, longer lived, less likely to get mugged, raped, and so on than, say, compared to 500 years ago. It's much better, thanks to liberal democracy and free markets.
Hmm. Well, it may, of course, depend on which part of the world you're talking about.
Well, yeah, okay. So, but those are theocracies in these awful third world nations. They're either dictatorships or theocracies. Hmm. So it's not that religion is bad. It's that any form of extremism where there's a monopoly of power, whether it's a theocracy, a dictatorship, or whatever, that's the danger. Mm-hmm. Religion's fine most of the time. It's extreme religion, just like extreme Marxist cultures are very dangerous. Any kind of extreme monopolistic power, like dictatorships and theocracies, that's the problem.
Uh-huh. Like those we face now in this war on terrorism.
That's right.
Uh-huh.
Yep. One of the reasons that Americans are so much more religious than Europeans,
yes,
is that Europeans don't have a free market of religion. We have a free market of religion here. Religions have to compete for limited customers, and they've gotten much better at doing religion. They're more flexible. They're more tolerant. They're more willing to change in order to give people what they need and want, and that's what free markets do. In Europe, the churches all get the same amount of tax dollars, no matter how many people are out there in the pews.
Mm-hmm.
So they're not motivated to try to update their religion, try to make their religion relevant for the people sitting in the pews, whereas American religions are very vibrant and flexible because they have to be.
Yeah.
The value of separating church and state. It's much better for religion. Christians that are in favor of blending church and state, they don't get that. They don't see that it's actually bad for them to do this.
Well, heaven knows, that keeps up. Pretty soon we'll have rap in church. You'll go to Sunday church service, and they'll rap it to you. Maybe that's the future. Dr. Michael Shermer is here.
There's something happening here, but what it is ain't exactly clear. There's a man with a gun over there, telling me I got to beware. I think it's time we stop. Children, what's that sound? Everybody look what's going down. There's battle lines being drawn.